I work kind of funny, yeah. I put everything under the umbrella of filmmaking, so I really don't try to put stuff in departments. I produce, I write, I direct, and sometimes act, and for me, that all goes under the thing of a filmmaker.
An American, you're an African who happens to be an American. You have to understand the difference. We didn't come over on the Nita, the Pinta, and the whatchamacallit. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. Landed right on top of us.
One day I was going through my correspondence, unanswered mail, and I've got mail that I haven't answered in about 5-10 years, you know, because I still, in one of these days, I'm going to get to it. So I'm looking over mail that came to me many years ago, and I see a letter from a young man named Spike Lee, and I opened the letter. I hadn't opened it before, and he said, "My name is Spike Lee. I am the son of George Lee, who is working with you and your wife down at the Village Vanguard as a musician, backing you up in your performance. I intend to be a filmmaker, and one of these days I intend to work with you and your wife." I got the actual letter from the past, and I was absolutely shocked and amazed. Why I had saved the letter, I have no idea. Why I had not opened it before that time, I do not know. Why that letter was sitting there at that moment, calling, you know, when the time to open the letter came, it was there for me to open. I was so shocked and amazed and desirous of saving this letter for Spike that I put it somewhere very carefully, waiting for the proper moment to give it to Spike. I put it away so carefully I haven't found it yet, but when I do, I intend to soak it in pure gold and give it to Spike. So it's almost mystical, you know. It's almost like a pre-ghost story, but it's true, every word of it.
The nickname Spike was given to me by my mother, who has since passed. She died when I was a sophomore in college. She said I was a tough baby, and the nickname stuck. My real name is Shelton Jackson Lee.
Shelton Jackson Lee, better known to the world as Spike Lee, has established himself as one of Hollywood's most important and influential filmmakers. He has been quoted as saying, "I've been blessed with the opportunity to express the views of black people who otherwise don't have access to power and the media. I have to take advantage of that while I'm still bankable."
I went to movies growing up. And we lived in this neighborhood in Cobble Hill, and the theater was called Alito. It was on the neighborhood theater on Court Street, and every Saturday we'd go to the matinees, act crazy and throw stuff at the screen and try not to get thrown out. But it never occurred to me that people actually make movies and that kind of stuff. You just went to the movie theater and have a good time.
Born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1957 and raised in Brooklyn, New York, Spike returned south long enough to attend Morehouse College, then back to Brooklyn to continue his education at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts in Manhattan, where he received his Master of Fine Arts degree in film production. In 1982, while still at NYU, he made a student film titled Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. It won the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Student Award and became the first student work ever shown in Lincoln Center's New Directors, New Films Showcase.
My thesis film was a film called Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. It's about a barbershop that also fronts as our numbers join, and I was fortunate enough to win one of the Student Academy Awards that year. And being young and dumb and naive, I thought that because of this award that all the studios would call me up, and I would, within a year, be directed and filmed in Hollywood.
And cut!
Spike waited patiently for the big studio offers to come pouring in, but funding for his films was not forthcoming. Upon receiving the Student Academy Award, Spike said, "I thought now that I had this award, the big studios would call me. I waited by the phone until it got turned off. That's when I decided I'd have to do it more independently." Over the years, Spike's accomplishments have included numerous television commercials, among them Nike Air Jordans and Levi's 501 jeans. He has produced and directed over 35 music videos and written 7 books. Yet his most important and influential work remains his outspoken and controversial feature films. In 1986, Spike independently raised $175,000 to produce his first professional feature, She's Gotta Have It, the story of an African-American woman's simultaneous sexual relationships with 3 different men. The title role of Nola was played by Tracy Camilla Johns.
"I want you to know the only reason I'm consenting to this is because I wish to clear my name. Not that I care what people think, but enough is enough. And if in the end it helps some other people out, well, then that's fine, too. I consider myself normal, whatever that means. Some people call me a freak. I hate that word. I don't believe in it. Better yet, I don't believe in labels. But what are you going to do? This was the deal."
The reason why I wore so many hats and She's Gonna Have It was it was fiscally sound. We had no money. Of all the 10 films I've done, that for me, that's the most difficult one to watch, though, because some of the acting bothers me, and I take full blame anytime there's a bad act in the film. It's the director's fault. Either they weren't directing, or they cast the wrong people. And in this case, I think it was really my inexperience as a director.
Spike's second film, School Days, was released in 1988. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote, "There is no doubt in my mind that School Days, in its own way, is one of the most honest and revealing movies I've seen about modern middle-class black life in America. The film featured such rising stars as Samuel L. Jackson, Lawrence Fishburne, Jasmine Guy, Branford Marsalis, and the venerable Ossie Davis."
"This is not for you. Gamma men are real men."
"I am a real man, a gamma man."
"Will you ask to speak? You're not a gamma man yet. Brothers, I suspect this sawed-off human being hasn't even had a girl yet."
School Days, for me, was my 4 years at an African-American institution, jam-packed into a homecoming week, and I wanted to look at some of the issues that keep African-Americans from being a more unified people. These issues really being superficial stuff based on skin complexion, whether you're light skin or dark skin, whether you got, quote, good hair or, quote, bad hair, which is nappy, you know, whether you're in fraternity or not, and, you know, what class you come from. And so if you wanted to use the college campus as a microcosm, as an African-American community as a whole.
In 1989, Spike released Do the Right Thing, which was called by many the most controversial film of the year, and starred Danny Aiello, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, John Turturro, and of course, Spike Lee. Award nominations were received from the Academy Awards, Cannes Film Festival, New York Film Critics, and the Golden Globe Awards.
The idea for Do the Right Thing came from several places. Number one, just living here in New York and seeing the racial animosity, the tension. So I got this idea, you know, let's have one block in Bedford-Stuyvesant, the hottest day of the summer, and have a group of different ethnic groups, and which really reflects the city as a whole.
That's one thing that I so admire about Spike. He seems to have an uncanny ability to wed the actor to the part, so that there's very little gap between the actor and the role itself. Somehow he saw my mother in me, I think.
"Hey, you old drunk! What did I tell you about drinking in front of my stoop? Move on, you're blocking my view. You are ugly enough. Don't stare at me. The evil eye doesn't
mother sister. You've been talking about me for 18 years. What have I ever done to you?
You a drunk fool.
Besides that, the mayor don't bother nobody. And nobody don't bother the mayor. But you. The mayor just tend to his own business. I love everybody. I even love you.
Hold your tongue. You don't have that much love.
One day, you're going to be nice to me. We may both be dead and buried, but you're going to be nice. At least civil.
I think it was a true document of racism at the time. And, you know, that therefore, that's why people like Joe Klein and David Denby and people like that said that this film would incite black youths all over the country who come out of the theaters and start riots.
You looking for trouble?
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble?
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
You're a boyfriend. Always coming to the look of trouble, huh? Suppose I busted your head, how would you...
Mookie, you want to get your friend out of here?
Well, you gonna kick me out now? Are you gonna kick me out, huh?
No, I'm not kicking you out. You're kicking yourself out.
What? Look, we got some brothers up on the wall, you know? Malcolm X, Nelson Mandela, you know, Michael Jordan. Tomorrow.
Come on, you get him out, all right?
I'm trying to get him out.
I'm paying for it.
I know you paid for it. Let's go.
Yeah, all right, all right. So you're kicking me out. Beat me in the head. You're going to kick me out, right?
Come on, let's
go. Okay, bet. Yeah, all right. Let's go. Look, I paid for my... Look, boycott sounds.
Go.
Yo, boycott sounds. I got your boycott swinging.
Boycott sounds. Yo, what you laughing at?
Well, Danny Aiello had a definite ideal how he wanted to play that role.
To me, it was like... It was a wonderful position to be in, to be the only white family in an all-black neighborhood. And I wanted to work in this area, and maybe this is my way of saying to the people in the area, hey, you know, not everybody is like you think they are.
Sonny, how's the vegetables, eh?
Good morning, Doc.
In the script, I mean, he's supposed to say the word nigger. And Danny would not say the word. I pulled Giancarlo Esposito over to the side because he was going to, it was a close-up of Danny, and I said, Giancarlo, really give it to him. So we rolled the camera, and Giancarlo started calling him, you fat guinea bastard, you stupid ass spaghetti bending, greasy Italian, whatever. And then something just clicked in Danny's mind. And it's what you see in a movie is that same take. I will kill you, nigga. I mean, it was like all this invective, he just started to vomit out of his mouth. And we're like, where did that come from? I thought you said you never used to.
You black motherfucker! You nigger motherfucker!
The film made money, only cost $6 million. Well, I made something like 30. We're on a lot of the best 10 list. Didn't have so much success with the Academy. Only got 2 nominations. Myself, Best Original Screenplay. And Dan, I said before, Best Supporting Actor. Best Film That He Was Driving His Days. I think that's very important that people really look back and say, you know, we're talking about the Academy. You got to do the right thing on one hand. And Driving Miss Daisy. Now look at fucking Morgan Freeman's role. That's the one, white America. That's the one the Academy was comfortable with. Subservient black man. Yes, Miss Daisy. Yes, yeah. Of course he got a nomination. Of course that's the best film of the year. So after that happened, I think that I finally woke up. Because up to that point, I think that the Academy and that kind of stuff was important to me. But not after that. I mean, you really cannot let any group have so much power over you that you need their validation. You know, unless you get the Academy Award or this or that, that your work is no value, it's not deemed necessary. You know, who are these people voting?
With regard to his commitment to his work, I think that there are many directors who are either attempting to conform to you know, the marketplace, what the market will bear, what the market wants to see. And I believe that with Spike, who is very aware of the market, but he has made a decision, I feel, about the kinds of films that he wants to make, the kinds of things he wants to say to his audiences, and he is heavily committed to that, and I really admire that in him, and I think that it sets him apart.
Mo Better Blues, a film about a black musician, was released in 1990. No doubt influenced by the fact that Spike's father was a musician, the movie featured Denzel Washington, who was forced by his parents to learn to play at an early age. He then goes on to become a great jazz musician. The film also featured Samuel L. Jackson, John Turturro, Nicholas Turturro, and Wesley Snipes.
He had talked to me about maybe doing something and Do the Right Thing, but I wasn't available. Then Denzel, who was cast as Bleak in Mo Better Blues, there was some little conflict and they didn't know if Denzel was going to be available or not. So he actually called me in Florida, when I was in Florida, my grandmother's house. And he says, I want you to play Bleak. I was like, well, what happened to Denzel? You know, I'm thinking this is a setup. You know, there's got to be a trick here somewhere. He says, well, yeah, that's a good question. All right, let me call you back. So then he calls me back about half an hour later and he says, okay, I want you to play Shadow. I was like, oh, okay, that makes more sense.
Shadow,
my man, how you doing?
What's up, Blake?
Oh, I'm good, everything's, whew. Listen, last time I looked at Clark's naked body, I didn't see my name on it anywhere, you know?
Yo, left, come
in. I mean, I didn't see it on a... Well, I didn't see it anyway, you know what I'm saying. So if you're trying to push up on it, don't sweat yourself, okay? Everything's okay. Nobody owns anybody.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Bleak. You know, you really should listen to Clark sing. Or is it that you can only hear your own music?
Mo Better really just comes from being the son of a great jazz musician and growing up around the music. And at the same time being a sports fan, I've always been interested in what happens to these guys or women who've had this one goal in life and they get a knee injury or a pitcher blows their arm out. Their life is over and they're only 25. What do you do the rest of your life? And so therefore we just applied that to music. Bleak Gillian has been taking trumpet lessons since 4. His whole life is totally devoted to music. And because of an accident, him getting beat up and getting his mouth messed up, that he could no longer play the trumpet. And that was the first time I got to work with Wesley and Denzel.
Me and the cats want to have a meeting after this. Get out of your face, man. Look, we need to talk about the money. We need to talk about the money, man. You see what I'm saying? You see them people out there? It's packed. Look, I ain't playing shit no more, man, until I deal with this money situation.
Get out of my face, y'all.
Yo, man, listen to what I'm saying.
Man.
Get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. What are you pushing, man?
Oh,
God.
Oh,
fuck you up.
Please. Take
it down. Hey, hey, hey.
Wesley Snipes returns as the star of Spike's 1991 release of Jungle Fever, a story of interracial relationships, drugs, and crime. Also starring in the film were Annabella Sciorra, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, Samuel L. Jackson, John Turturro, Anthony Quinn, and Spike himself. Samuel L. Jackson received the Best Supporting Actor Award from both the Cannes Film Festival and New York Film Critics. And the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures nominated the film as one of the 10 best films of that year.
Jungle Fever, again, came out of a incident here in New York. The murder of Yusef Hawkins, African-American man who stumbles into a crowd of Italian-American youths looking for this guy, and Joey Fama pulls out a gun and shoots him.
You are not my son!
Whoa, damn!
Oh, Louie! You bastard! Oh, take it easy! You're not my son!
Come on, relax!
Take it easy! What's the matter?
Where you going, Paulie, huh?
Paulie, where'd you burn it? Paulie, eh?
Paulie, who's the lucky girl?
Hey, you look pretty.
You know what,
Paulie? Yeah? You going out with that nigger? Fucking nigger?
Patty!
You think you're better than me, Paulie? Huh?
Paulie,
huh?
You fucking
disgrace this table,
Paulie.
You're fucking disgrace, an asshole. You know better than me. Where's your fucking bully, huh? Where's your fucking bully?
Where's your fucking bully? Where's your motherfucker?
Go! Go!
If you remember, I played the part of the stern minister father whose sons got away from him. One of the sons went into drug addiction and became a bit of a monster. And the father, distraught and temporarily deranged, I could say, eventually winds up killing his own son. Well, this was not a minor statement to be made about father-son relationships, particularly because in the black community we have a special problem with father-son relationships. So I wanted to make sure that Spike, in going after the father-son relationship, was not exploiting that which was merely sensational. I think in the end that Spike's choices were right, but they were so important and so potentially disturbing that I had, as a friend and as an actor and as a black man, you know, to raise a few questions to Spike. And we had to go to the mat on several occasions. But we did it as father and son, as friends, before the production started. When I came to the moment, I was able to give fully to the moment because Spike and I had come to a common understanding of what it was about.
My own flesh and blood, my firstborn son, and I love you, but you're evil and you're better off dead.
All right, all right! Leave!
That devil's work I've never done. The devil is always busy.
Mama, check out this new step. I made this one up just for you.
I paid a lot of money for these, honey. Take it. For God's sake, please. Go.
I pray for you, my son. Father, I stretch my hands to thee.
Of all the films I've done, I think probably one has been misinterpreted the most is Jungle Fever. People, because they see the film and they think that Spike Lee's against, you know, interracial relationships, and the film was saying that at all. This film was just looking at, I think, a frank discussion, or look at two people coming together for what we feel or what could be the wrong reasons. Is that how you build a relationship? Is that a base for it? Because you think that all black men are, you know, 10-foot long penises and superhuman sexual studs, or because it, you believe deep down in your heart that the white women are the epitome of beauty? I mean, and those are the reasons why those two got together.
Where are you from?
Bensonhurst.
Mm. Nice neighborhood.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Uptown.
Bronx?
No. Harlem.
Harlem, USA.
Wow.
You ever been there? No? You never been to Harlem?
No. I never met anybody from Harlem. I mean, not Bensonhurst, anyway.
Well, you know, you should, go. I mean, I think you'd like it. I mean, there's a lot of nice people up there.
Yeah.
I understood where he wanted to go with the project, and I knew what he was trying to accomplish. I've said this to him before. I've said this to you. Yeah, I just felt like, you know, there needed to be more relationship aspects of it. You know, to get the audience to believe that these two people really, really liked one another. You know, judged in Spike's barometer, it was love. It was overwhelming love, but you know, I don't think the audience was as convinced.
You know, Angie, I've never cheated on my wife before. I mean, I'm married, happily married.
I know. I kind of figured that.
Wait.
I think Spike does rely on your knowing what it is he wants you to do, and also on a kind of spontaneous giving to the moment beyond what's in the script, because there are instances in Jungle Fever, for example, where people do get together and seem to improvise the whole scene, and I like the fact that Spike takes risks like that, gorgeous risks I call them, because marvelous things come when talented people get together around an idea and flesh it out.
The War Council scene, I knew that I could not write that scene, so in the script it's just like a blueprint, and I just felt that all I had to do was get the right actors, turn the cameras on, and we would be there all day. They're talking about what black men had done to them, what they did and hadn't done. So that's what happened. I couldn't write that stuff. We just turned the camera on.
How many men do you know, black men, who can effectively deal with a mate who has more education and makes more money? Not many. They freak, and y'all know I'm telling the truth.
I know.
No, the fact remains is that we are losing our men. That's the bottom line.
A lot of this doesn't really so much have to do with the black men. I know it does, and I know we want to blame them, and it is their blame.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it is that these white bitches throw themselves at black men. Do you see the
Thank
way they
you.
Look at them?
Mm-hmm.
You can't walk down the street with your man without 29,000 white bitches coming on to them, and they will
Thank
give up
you.
The pussy because their fathers tried to keep it from them all their lives. When they turn 18 and they leave home, they're
That's
gonna
it.
Get that black dick.
Yeah.
They're gonna get it. They're gonna yeah. get it, and it can be yours, or mine, and they want it.
My number one priority, even above interracial stuff, was showing how crack is destroying African American family in this country. That for me, that was more the story. We just used that black white interracial thing as a hook to bring. You know, to get people interested in the film.
The big screen story of Malcolm Little, who became Malcolm X, was released by Spike in 1992. It was Spike's attempt at celebrating the whole sweep of an American life that began in sorrow and bottomed out on the streets and in prison before its hero, Malcolm X, reinvented himself. The film received nominations and recognition from the Academy Awards, the MTV Awards, New York Film Critics, and the Golden Globe Awards. The talented cast was headed by Denzel Washington in the title role, along with Angela Bassett, Al Freeman Jr., Delroy Lindo, and Teresa Randall.
I would say all my films was a labor of love, but a lot was riding on Malcolm X and Denzel. I knew that. We repeatedly joke during that year that we were making the film that, you know, we both had our tickets to leave the country. We would be able to slip out under the cover of darkness, and things didn't turn out well. And for the most part, people, you know, if a film turns out bad, it's not a crime. But African Americans were reminding Denzel and I every day, you know, just you walking down the street, don't mess up Malcolm X, don't mess up Malcolm X.
When my mother was pregnant with me, a party of Klansmen on horseback surrounded our house in Omaha, Nebraska. They brandished guns and shouted for my father to come out. My mother went to the door where they could see her pregnant condition and told them that my father was in Milwaukee preaching.
He's in Milwaukee preaching.
Now, these hooded Klansmen said the good white Christians would not stand for his troublemaking and to get out of town. Every window with their rifle butts before riding off into the night. They rode off into the moonlight on their horses as suddenly as they had come.
There were many times when the crew, we would have to pinch ourselves because we thought we saw the reincarnate of Malcolm. I mean, Malcolm's spirit was definitely going through Denzel when he shot this film, and it's evident, you know, if you see the film now.
And without any further ado, I present to you Brother Minister Malcolm, and I pray that you and I will listen, hear, and understand. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Get your hand out of my pocket! Get out of my pocket, nigga! Get your hands out of my
brother,
pocket! Your hands out
brother,
pocket.
Please, hold it. Calm down, please. Hold it. Go.
I was not a sort of a real-life character of any importance in Malcolm's life. Therefore, there was no part for me in the story of Malcolm. I was only a part in the public's mind of some importance at the end of his life, at the funeral, where the community had the responsibility of arranging a proper send-off for a very revolutionary, incendiary, and controversial figure around whose life and death there were still such tensions that some of us expected that even at the funerals, bombs would be thrown. Spike wanted that statement about Malcolm's life to be a part of the film, to be a part at the very end, and I agreed.
Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still.
I think that as a filmmaker, what you have to do is try to get the spirit of that individual. At the same time, you know, you still have to try to be as truthful as possible. So it's really like walking a tightrope.
I think Spike did an excellent job with Malcolm X. I'd like to be around 20 years from now when he does it again, after he himself has matured more, after he's been black a little bit longer, after he's had time to let certain aspects of our culture and philosophy sink more deeply into who he is. After he takes a second look, there'll be other things that he will see. And I'd love to be here when he does the second Malcolm X.
Lee's 1994 release of Crooklyn was written by Spike with his sister Joie Susanna Lee and his brother Cinque Lee. Although Lee insists it is not an autobiography, it was inspired by his and his siblings' early family memories. The outstanding cast included Alfre Woodard, Delroy Lindo, Isaiah Washington, and once again, Spike Lee.
I'll say a substantial part of Crooklyn is autobiographical. My sister Joie came up to me and said, me and Sankey had this story and want you to read it. So I said, all right. And I was really surprised how good it was. And then I said, oh, you know, I want to help you make it, but it just needs to be rewritten, you know, fleshed out. And they agreed to that. But the script was an answer for her need to finally let go of the past of our mother. Joie is that 10-year-old girl, Troy, who grows up in a male-dominated household in Brooklyn during the early 70s.
Window, please close your mouth when you chew.
What can I eat peaceful with?
Because you're disturbing the peace. You like a pig. You chew like a cow.
Yeah.
Come on, Jim. It's a compliment to your good cooking. Like now,
compliment my butt. That boy is plain greedy.
You
didn't eat nothing.
Yes, I did. I ate green tea.
Mom, I'm so
sorry. See? Your eyes are bigger than your stomach.
May I please be excused?
No, you may not. You can sit there till you eat every black-eyed pea on your plate.
Spike had a way of very matter-of-factly telling you what he wanted you to know. Just in sort of, you know, spurts. And it would come to him at different times, but we sat around a big room for, I don't know, a week, maybe a couple weeks after that. And on couches, sort of going through scene by scene, because they were the children, and you have to rehearse a different way with children.
Well, the biggest challenge working with children actors is trying not to kill them. Trying not to grab them by their skinny necks and choke them to death. That is the biggest challenge.
He made me laugh because he would say things to them like, they read through it and they go, "Nah, that was fake. Do it again."
There's nothing worse than a child actor. And so we really try to stay away from children who were actors, who had agents, you know, stage mothers and stuff like that. So we went to public schools to cast a lot of people.
It looks funny.
It looks stupid.
So look at yours.
At least mine's gonna look all funny like yours.
Well, at least mine isn't standing on my head to stay strong and grow like Topsy.
I don't know who's Topsy is, but what I know, it looks stupid and I can't stand it.
I can't stand you either.
Why don't you sit down with your old black self?
I'm black, yeah, and I'm brown.
She got good hair.
She got Puerto Rican hair.
I know, man. Stop scorching me, ugly.
Don't you be calling my sister ugly. I'll slap you in the neck quick.
You're not gonna slap nobody in next week, right, stupid?
Minnie, why don't you get off my stoop? You think you're so pretty.
I can't stand you either, Minnie. You think you're so cute.
Stop waiting for you. You think you're so cute.
Come on, y'all. Who wants to jump rope?
I don't.
I'm
playing.
Playing.
I don't want to play.
I do. Wait. We playing all Brandon and Captain. Y'all turn it.
Why y'all got to tell us what to do?
I know. Right? I'm older now. Give me no lip. Let's go.
Spike's 1995 release of Clockers starred Harvey Keitel, John Turturro, and Delroy Lindo. Originally set as a Martin Scorsese project, Spike stepped in as the film's director when Scorsese decided to direct Casino instead.
Clockers is a low-run drug dealer, someone who's out there actually selling the goods. You know, he's like a soldier. And they're out there on those benches on the streets 24 hours a day. You know, when you go to a job, you punch a clock. Well, you know, they say they're clocking dollars. So that's how the term came up.
Yo, Shirley, you're smart, right? Answer me this. Boss buys him a key for $22,000, right? Cuts it up to $3,500, $10 bottles. Boss takes 60%, $17,000 profit, leaving up $7,000. 50% of which is mine. How much for me?
$3,500.
My man Shorty. Keep hitting them books, all right? If I ever catch you playing hooky, put a chap in your ass.
Anybody who's conscious, I think, had to feel concerned about at the alarming rate that young African American males were killing each other. At the same time, we were dealing with this phenomena of a hip hop gangster shoot 'em up rap movie, which was a scourge at the time where all the studios, you know, were making films like that. And I was hesitant at first to do this film because of those reasons. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, number 20 on the list. Martin Scorsese originally supposed to have directed the film. Richard Price was writing the script for him, and De Niro was going to play the Harvey Keitel role. And Marty, you have to ask him why he changed his mind, decided he wanted to do Casino instead. And so I was asked to come in, and Marty stayed on as a executive producer. But what I wanted to do with my approach was really try to tell the story through the eyes of Strike, the 19-year-old crack dealer. In the novel, Richard Price alternated chapters between Rocco Klein and Strike. But in the script that he was writing with De Niro, the star, was all about Rocco Klein. So we had to change that focus. And we really wanted for this film to show some hope at the end, because so many of the films I mentioned before, it was just too bleak. And you leave the theater resigned to the fact, well, it just looks like every African-American kid in this country is not gonna be able to get past the 18th birthday. That's just the law. And I don't believe that.
Yo, Rocco, before I get out, man, just ask me this one question. Why were you so gung-ho about all this shit, man? Most cops, brothers killing other brothers, ain't no big thing, blase, blase. What made you care about me, my brother Victor, Darrell Adams, Tyrone, huh? What made you give a shit?
If I ever see you again, I'll book you on charges of criminal solicitation and conspiracy to commit murder. I'll let Andre beat you down again, then pick up Rodney on the same charges, and I'll make sure you two share the same cell, the same fucking bed. Do you understand me clearly?
Yeah, I understand you clearly. I just want to say thanks, you know, for getting me out of town, so.
Yes, I was very pleased with the film. At the same time, I thought that the audience, my premonition was true. You know, going in that, you know, they had just been, hit over the head enough with those type of films. Even though that was perceptive, even though this film was like an antithesis of those type of films, they still perceived it as another one of those hip-hop, rap, drug movies.
Spike's 1996 production of Girl 6 examines the life of an aspiring actress in New York who decides to take a job as a phone sex operator while awaiting her big acting break. As the story unfolds, Girl 6 becomes engrossed in her work and starts to lose touch with reality. Teresa Russell, who had worked in earlier Spike Lee films, played the title character.
Girl 6, in a lot of ways, was a return to what we did with the first film. She's going to have a film about empowerment of women, or the supposed empowerment of women, and what women, what choice they're faced with, and the decisions that they make and the ramifications of those decisions. About the stories about an actress, you never know her name, who until the end, who is struggling here in New York, unlike most struggling actors. If things aren't happening here, they feel that, let me go out to L.A. But she needs to finance that trip. You need an apartment, you need a car, you need money. So in order to finance this sojourn out to Lala, the Hollywood, Lala Land, she starts working at a phone sex operation and gets so hooked up in it, caught up in it, that she forgets why she even took the job in the first place. The job, you know, was to get her the money to go. And so she comes to that realization finally before it. Just before it's not too late.
I have never been so humiliated in all of my life.
Oh, come on, cut the sturm and drank. You want to be an actress? You want to be a star? You showed him your tits? So what? Big fucking deal, all right? Sharon Stone spread her legs. And look what happened. When I saw that, I said to myself, that's a star. He didn't ask you to have intercourse with him, did he?
No.
How did it go? Did you get the part?
I walked out.
You walked out on QT. The hottest director in Hollywood. I get you seen by QT. And you fucked. You know, maybe we should go another direction. You know, maybe somebody can do better by you. Listen, the money that you owe me, keep it, all right? This is too much aggravation. You know, with my asthma and everything like that, it's not working out. It's not worth it for me, okay?
But you're absolutely right. It's not working out. But that money that I owe you, I'm going to pay you back, Murray.
You better pay me back. Listen, let me tell you something. I respect you. I think you're a beautiful person. You're talented. And I wish you well, okay? Peace. Out. Okay, bye. Talk to you later.
There are no sex scenes in Girl 6. Everything is oral. It's all people talking on the phone. So, whereas in She Could Have It, it was visual. So that for me, that was interesting to do something that where it's just people talking, you know, and fantasies.
I've got a tight white T-shirt on and a little white skirt.
Chicken and
tea
shirt down for me.
Okay.
Bounce them up down for me.
Okay. Uh-huh. I'm bouncing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm bouncing right now, Steven.
Oh, yeah.
I'm on your lap. Uh-huh. And I'm bouncing my teeth up and down. These cheeks are moving up and down,
oh, yeah.
Steven.
Oh, bouncing for me, love. Honey.
My problem with critics is that they seem more involved with who they think Spike Lee is. They seem more involved with the persona or what their perception of Spike Lee is than with the actual work, what's on the screen. And therefore, because the fact that I am an actor, I'm in my film, I do other stuff that makes me known outside of the world of cinema, that this somewhat detracts from the real appreciation of the work, and people get caught up on the other stuff and don't really focus on what they're paid to be doing, which is looking at the work. And so, I mean, I'm reading a review and they're talking about me and Reggie Miller, and a Knick game. It has nothing to do with, you know, What that movie was about.
The Million Man March on Washington, D.C. was the subject of Spike's 1996 film, Get on the Bus. Some critics called it Spike's finest work. Made for less than $3 million and financed by such high-powered luminaries as Danny Glover, Will Smith, Johnny Cochran, Wesley Snipes, and Robert Guillaume, the film was not widely seen by audiences, but reinforced Spike's presence as an important American filmmaker. Charles Dutton headed a powerful cast that included Richard Belzer, DeAndre Bonds, Andre Brower, and Ossie Davis.
Two producers, Bill Borden and Barry Rosenbusch, came up with the initial idea for this film, and they contacted, being white, they knew that it might be difficult for them to do this film alone, so they contacted the great casting director, Ruben Kahn, who had been looking to make that segue into production, into producing films. And Ruben called me and told me about this film. I agreed to do it. And it was mentioned by Bill that Columbia Pictures is going to finance this film. And at the time, the budget was $2.4 million. And I just felt that if we were going to try to keep with the spirit of the march, Ruben and I should be able to raise a measly $2.4 million then let Columbia, some other studio, finance it out, right? And that's what we did.
So, Mike, how come you're going to the march?
Because I'm thinking this could be Black Monday, man.
Black Monday, what do you mean?
I'm saying this could all be a setup. This could be like a conspiracy, man. We could be on our way to get it done. This could be like the trains in the Dachau and Auschwitz. You know what I'm saying? It could be, man. You know what I'm saying? Think about it. Think about all the trains, planes, and cars filled with black men headed to D.C. right now. Thousands, right? Thousands. And if I'm a crazy white man in the U.S. government and I want to kill a million black men in one fell swoop, just hit one button and boom, when and where would I do it? At the Million Man Mark. And the next day, when we all dead, who's gonna fight our battle? None of the black women left. This is some apocalyptical type shit about to happen, baby, man. That's what I'm saying.
You going? Jay, you going to the march for the same reason?
No, I'm not. I'm going to the meeting for myself. I think it's time for folks to stand up and be responsible. Get out the begging mentality that we have. Hook me up, said, look out for a brother. We need to start looking out for ourselves.
Strong black businessman over here.
It was very challenging as a director to try to come up with something. You know, photograph this bus, this confined space, so it would not be monotonous and not lull the audience to sleep. So we used different film stocks. Because of the small space, the environment really decided that we shoot it on Super 16. I like to shoot with two cameras, and two 35 cameras would not have been able to fit in that bus.
I know we came 3,000 miles to attend the march, and it didn't happen. But at least we stood by the brother when he needed us, and that's got to mean something. We're here because God Almighty wanted us here. And he don't care so much about what you already done. God asks what you gonna do now.
I think it's a very good film. At the same time, we're very disappointed that the audience did not respond like we thought they would. And, you know, and then not that many people came to see the film. And I think that there was a large perception out there that this is a documentary. You know, people thought this film was not entertaining, that they would be getting a history lesson. That did not change, you know, the response box office did not affect how I feel about this film or what we accomplished by doing it.
The thing I respect about Spike deeply is his commitment to his own vision. Whether one agrees with it or not, he is committed to what he is doing and the people that he is presenting to his audiences. From that standpoint, I think he is saying, this is what I see, these are the individuals that I see, these are the individuals I'm presenting to you, accept it or not.
Well, I just love what I do. I love what I do. I've been blessed. Not everyone gets to do what makes them the happiest. I say this all the time, 99% of the people in the world go to their grave, you know, six feet under, having worked at a job they hated all their lives. And that's not the case for me. I think movies cost too much. And so much is riding on these films. And people are scared to make interesting films. So everybody's looking for this big blockbuster, and a lot of these movies suck. They're terrible. Right now, the struggle is for African American directors to get films made dealing with other aspects of our culture, or they get films that cost as much as everybody else's, and it gets money, the same amount of money spent. Right now, there are no African American executives holding jobs at studios who could greenlight a picture. There's very few people in the marketing departments, the booking departments. So we need much greater diversity and representation in the studios.
ironically, if you think about the number of young black actors and artists in front of the camera and behind the scenes, the majority of them working in Hollywood right now have come through Spike in some capacity or another. You know, for everything from actors to editors, sound people, cinematographers, you know. A lot of people have come through 40 Acres and a Mule.
When I consider Spike and try to explain to myself, to my children, to Spike himself, what I consider unique about him, I always settle on the fact that Spike violated the unwritten contract between the black man and white America. That contract which says that a black man, in order to succeed, must conform to all of even the stereotypes that the whites expect, that he must never be pushy, must never be forward, he must never challenge the white man and his assumptions about blacks whatsoever. And he must be a very nice guy. He must, in other words, do what Jackie Robinson had to do. Bite his tongue, hide his manhood and his anger, and be an angel. Spike came out and said, to hell with that, I'm going to be a devil. And I'm going to make it work. And Spike is unique in the fact that he confronts the motion picture establishment on its own terms, on its own grounds, and he gives as good as he gets. Spike Lee is the one man I know who could have sat at ease around the table with the people who invented Hollywood, the Cecil B. DeMilles, the Samuel Goldwyns, and all of those men who had that big vision. Spike would have been there. I don't know whether he would have smoked a cigar or not, but Spike could have talked the same talk that they talked, because Spike thinks the same thoughts that they think. Spike sees Hollywood as it is now, but also he sees potentially what Hollywood itself often does not see, what it can do and what it should do. He's a great contributor to film in American society.
Any artist wants to be remembered by their work. You know, that's all you can do. I think that what has happened with this country and this society is that people are evaluated and put in context only having done one album, one novel, one movie, one play. And that's crazy. How are you going to really intelligently evaluate someone who's only done one thing? You can only do that. Smart people know you only do that when an artist develops a body of work. So that's how you evaluate art. At the end of the day, what was your body of work? So that's always been the goal, to try to build a body of work.